Why Fenway? Exploring the Red Sox mystique. This is a gentleman who we've not had on the program previously, an author and photographer who he and I have not even spoken off air. Having said that, we have a good friend in common, it seems. Ken Palmer, who has been one of our favorite recurring guests here on the program, who, like this gentleman here tonight, was set up for the program by our senior producer, the FDH New York Bureau, Steve Servillo. So with Ken Palmer in common and recommending him very highly to us, really looking forward to this segment. Author John W. Ferguson, as I say, the book is Why Fenway, Exploring the Red Sox Mystique. We're glad to bring him on. John, welcome to the FDH Lounge. Sir, how are you tonight?
I'm pretty good, Rick, and I hope I can prove to be adequate filler.
Well, I'm very glad we were able to get you on tonight. I want to thank you and your publishing house for getting a copy of the book to us, and I really have enjoyed reading it, and I didn't know exactly when we were going to get you on, but I'm very pleased that it's tonight, getting a chance to talk about this as we approach what is almost the centennial of Fenway Park, and no doubt there are going to be many great events marking that over the course of the next year. As is the case a lot of times with a project like this, let's just start with the genesis of it. Why Fenway? I ask you, why the book? How did this come to happen?
Well, I worked covering the Red Sox from 91 through the 2004 championship season, and I grew up a Red Sox fan. I've been to that tiny little ballpark a million and one times. I'm working there again tomorrow, just doing some creative stuff for the ball team. Of course, they're going to come out with their own commemorative book, and I happen to be pretty handy with a camera, so I'm sure I can make some more interesting images for them as well. But after I left covering baseball, because, I still work with the New York Giants, and you were mentioning our good friend Ken Palmer, that guy and I have traveled more miles on the road covering Giants games, Penn State games, Phillies. We go to the Phillies all the time, so... You know, just one of the greatest characters in sports journalism. But the whole thing with the Fenway book is I had stepped away from baseball. I knew the centennial was going to be coming up, and I have proven to be a fairly decent architectural type photographer. I also work with Getty Images in their entertainment division, so I'm no stranger to shooting celebrities. So I just wrapped everything all up into one nice little package, and we decided to call it Why Fenway right at the table as I signed my book deal. And the people at Triumph Books couldn't be nicer, and I'm glad they got you a nice copy as well.
Oh, I've really enjoyed it a lot. It's the photography is excellent. It's very striking, and it's a tribute to the writing and some of the features in here that they're not overshadowed by the photography, because it would be easy to have that happen otherwise with the full color, very jarring photographs that are in this thing. There are many different interesting elements as well when we talk about the different subjects that are covered within. One of the things of greatest interest to me was how close this came to just going down the turlet here, 10, 15 years ago, as this movement was going to get kind of a new Fenway Park. And again, as you point out in the course of the book here, I mean, that's something where it would have been a very definitive before and after period time for the Red Sox, and one where the after period would not look nearly as bright as it does today.
Well, I'll tell you, Rick, to even preface that a couple of decades previous, it's the reason the Red Sox are still in Boston is Fenway Park, because had Ted Williams and the Hank Aaron thing kind of worked out a couple of years different, where maybe Hank Aaron arrived on the scene a couple of years earlier and Ted Williams was waning, the Red Sox may not have been in Boston, because it certainly couldn't support two ball clubs, and finally the Braves did leave to go to Milwaukee and eventually Atlanta today. But, the whole thing with Fenway Park is it's got its own mystique. It's got its own culture. It's got its own vibe. And if I can just illuminate even a fraction of that in my book, Why Fenway, which is available at Amazon.com, by all means, I hope I do, because like Bill Lee said, he wrote the foreword to the book as well. Bill Lee said, if you're a baseball fan and you own a coffee table, why Fenway is on it, period. I don't care if you're a Yankee fan. I don't care if you're a Brewers fan. Most baseball fans are fairly knowledgeable. And to know more and to embrace more with Fenway Park as the people who saw to right the ship and save Fenway Park, which was the movement in the late 90s, because things almost moved down the street, or even, you know, Frank McCourt had his way and got ownership of the team, we'd have a nice waterside ballpark that was in bankruptcy, or, you know, something crazy like that would have happened. So fortunately, the right people came along, and they are the keepers of the gate. And, you know, one of the things that, I've talked with Larry Lucchino, I just met a couple of weeks ago. We're doing this in any event. We're doing some things. One of the things is the preservation of Fenway Park for the future, and then for people to embrace the park. Because, you know, Rick, I'm in Boston right now, and I work shooting architecture throughout New England in for the summer. And I tell you, man, there's a lot of sentiment around that they just should have built a new ballpark. But those are mostly from people that are older, or people that are larger, you know, and somebody who's 6'5", just a brick of a man. You know, those tiny little seats, they're going to let you know that they're hugging you real tightly. You know what I mean?
Right, right. I know exactly what you mean by that. And there's a lot of people that romanticize the new and essentially just want the yuppie experience. You pointed out in the book something like the Phillies ballpark, which I've never been to, but would like to here at some point. We've actually got a fair number of connections through our show to the Phillies organization.
I'd
like to just go out there and get a chance to meet everybody face-to-face for once. That ballpark looks very appealing to me, and I'd like to do that. You point out in the book, that's an upgrade from where they were previously. The multi-use abominations of the 60s and 70s that they had there, like the Vet and some of these other ones, big upgrade there. That would be a humongous downgrade from Fenway, because you really couldn't construct anything that's got the character of that place. That one and Wrigley, and it's no coincidence, they're the last two that are standing here at this point, and figure to be the last two standing, really irreplaceable in every sense of the word.
Right, and one of the things that the new ownership did rediscover, because for a long time, you know, FDR gave a campaign speech there back in the 40s. Actually, he gave his last campaign speech at Fenway Park. You know, the bands that have played there previous to the current, you know, Springsteens, and like I have in the book, Jake Alice and Aerosmith, people like that, there used to be performances at Fenway Park all the time. And they rediscovered that, of course, by having the frozen Fenway. There's also been numerous concerts, movie premieres going on there. But one of the things that Fenway Park allows, it is progressive. It's not a modern ballpark, but it is a progressive ballpark. And the people that saw right to keep it around also, you know, opened up some of the venues which had been shut down by the previous ownership when they built that terrarium. You know, the 600 Club there, which was glassed in, and you'd have to listen to the game through speakers instead of actually, you know, smelling the smells and then hearing the chants of Let's Go Sox with the guy right next to you out in the open. So, you know, they were looking for a yuppie experience, as you alluded to. But moreover, I think to capture the true baseball experience, and yeah, you know what, you can get a mixed drink and you can get a nice piece of carved beef up in the sweet section, but you know what, you can just regularly go down on the street and get a sausage and a nice pepper sandwich and get yourself a beer and sit down and enjoy a beautiful ball game in the most beautiful ballpark.
Well, you talk about it as a progressive ballpark. It is a blue state, John, so I guess that is kind of fitting to have that there, so to speak. But something I'd like to ask you about, if you'd heard this, I didn't see any reference to it in the book unless I missed it. And I don't know if this is urban legend or not, but a good friend of ours, Russ Cohen from Sportsology, who covers the Winter Classic every year, when he was up for the Winter Classic in 2010, he was writing a column about the history of Fenway. He was unable to substantiate it, but he had heard something about some type of big-time bowling exhibition at Fenway in the late 50s. Did you ever hear anything about that, Don Carter and some of the boys?
I did not hear that it took place at Fenway Park, but I heard that there was something of that nature in the Fenway area, on Lansdowne Street or over on what was, it's now Yawkey Way, but it was Jersey Street. I don't know if they actually did it inside the ballpark, but it didn't seem like it was, you know, a major event or anything of that sort. It's not like, you know, when the Fenway Park has been the gridiron for almost every incarnation of professional football in Boston, including the Patriots, you know? So it's shown its flexibility over the years. And now, like you mentioned, with the frozen Fenway, the concerts, blah, 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 they have picnics in the park. They're doing everything. So it's a very welcoming place that, I affectionately call in the book several times home. And for a lot of us Red Sox fans, and even people that have never been to Fenway Park and know nothing about the Boston Red Sox, there's something very captivating about the way it's lit, like in the late afternoon, and it's just glowing, and there's a few buildings, and, everybody's so nice and tight in the, nowhere else. It is the original. It is one of the last remaining little encampments, our own little fort that we made ourselves. It's our own New England folk art. So with all that romantic jargon I just threw out there, it's a pretty damn nice place to see a ball game.
Well, and you must have gotten a lot of stories from people in the course of putting this book together because, for example, like I'm a lifelong Cleveland resident. I've only ever been to a game there once. It was a school trip. I was out in New England in 85. They were taking our advanced English class out to see some of the historical sites in the area and some of the literature places and blah, blah, blah. But I just wanted to get to a game at Fenway, and there were a bunch of us that did the one night. Red Sox and the Angels, and if you can picture this, I mean, ships passing in the night. Roger Clemens and Reggie Jackson, and Clemens struck them out three times that night. And just the roar of that place, the third strikeout that night, you must have heard a million stories like that from people as you were writing the book and collecting all the info.
Oh, absolutely. And a lot of that I let the players tell themselves because, as you saw in the book, Rick, I got Dwight Evans in there, Freddie Lynn. I mean, Freddie Lynn perhaps was the greatest in his moment. I'm not going to stretch too far here, but in his first two or three years, he perhaps showed the most prowess in center field that any player had before, and I'm talking Joe DiMaggio as well. So that's just one man's opinion, but Freddie got banged up a little bit, but I let players like that, the guys from the past. Of course, Johnny Pesky's in the book. I just had dinner with Johnny a couple of weeks ago, and I just let people talk. And I recorded what they said, and I transcribed what they said. I didn't add any filler. There's no, bending or twisting or real editorializing at all. And, one of the things that he sums up, he's just like, it's always been the best ball field. We always had the best grounds crew, but it's the best-looking ballpark. And players would always add a little something like that. Dwight Evans, when he first got to Fenway, his first time up at bat, he wasn't doing too well. But he got out in the field and he made a stretched-out diving catch. And the Red Sox fans immediately said, "You're our guy." The nickname Dewey probably came about 3 days later when they started abbreviating his name. So, there's a lot of special things that have happened at Fenway Park. And it's just good to know that, like Nomar says in my book, that he's got a dent on that wall, just like Joe DiMaggio, just like Ted Williams. It's a special place for a lot of people, and a lot of those people are pretty special themselves.
It really is, and it's interesting because you just mentioned two guys there who a lot of Red Sox fans, clearly yourself included, over a period of time cherished hopes that they would be part of that championship team that would break through and win that first world championship since 1918. Nomar came close but was traded that year. I mean, we know what happened with him. He kind of broke down with the injuries and everything. But Fred Lynn, I find that to be a very interesting case. Back in 75, Rookie of the Year and MVP the same year. I'm not old enough to really remember 75, although I was alive, but I remember in his career a little bit later on. And what happened with that guy? Is it as simple as that he just kind of broke down? Was it a thing where he could never kind of recapture the start? Maybe that 75 season was a little bit misleading as to his skill level. Have you ever kind of reconciled that? Because he was there with kind of tail end Diaz. Had his career really panned out to what it was thought it was going to be, he would have been around for the beginning of Clemens. He would have had some windows there. So in your mind, what was the deal with Fred Lynn? Is it as simple as injuries?
I'll sum it up this way, Rick. The reason that there is padding on every major league outfield wall, infield wall, anywhere that a player could possibly hurt himself is because of Fred Lynn. Mm-hmm. If anybody is as old as I am, and I was 15 in 1975, so anybody out there can do the math, but Freddie, that first year was unbelievable. But I'll tell you, he took a whack against the wall I think it was in 77, and he just was never the same after that. And that is the reason why the outfield walls are padded in all the ballparks these days. I don't know if it's the Freddie Lynn rule or anything like that. But the guy played, you know, at 11 when normally everybody else is playing around a 9 or a 10. And he always did that. And you can read what he says in my book that, you know, there was just no chance of him ever doing anything else, even though at one point the bullpen used to have these metal rods that stood up out of the wall to prevent people from climbing over. Well, you know, when your center fielder is Freddie Lynn and he wants to reach over and grab a ball, he said he got himself hung up on those things a couple of times. And, you know, he played full out and he gave it all. And when he went out to California, where he's from, you know, things are a little lighter and a little freer out there. So maybe it wasn't as intense as it was in Boston, especially since, like, he says in the book, the people are right on top of you, and there'd be times where the ballpark could be so quiet and so still, just waiting for something to happen. You could hear the announcer, Sherm Feller, talking off microphone, having a candid conversation in between batters. So, you know, Freddie Lynn was a guy like many of the Red Sox, Jim Rice, probably Yastrzemski for sure. I mean, and you talk about Nomar, he set the table for 2004, lest anybody forget what he did himself as an MVP. Mm-hmm. You know, Nomar was just a great, great addition to the Boston Red Sox at a time where they really didn't have much to cling on to. And, you know, there was a reason they had Nomar Day last year, because everybody still loves him just like I do.
Yeah, I can understand that. And, he was a part of the team that year, albeit not at the very end, got moved at the trading deadline. Something I'd like to ask you, and it's a pretty logical segue on where you were going there with Freddie Lynn and the walls. One of the places, of course, that doesn't have padding on the walls would be where you got the ivy in the outfield at Wrigley. I've been reading some things recently about what's going to be needed.
That's organic padding, man. I mean, yeah. That's Mother Nature saying, hey, look, not only am I going to, you know, make it look nice here, but I'm going to take care of you, okay? You bump into the wall, ouch, maybe you get a scratch, but you're not going to break anything, you know?
Run into that at full speed and then get back to me on how much it hurts, John.
But, right.
You know, I've been reading some things recently about that park, the need to modernize in some ways, some things that they can do to kind of bring it into the modern age and would have to do, frankly, to kind of keep pace with the economics of baseball. So if the good folks at Wrigley, I guess no longer the Tribune Company, but the new ownership of the Cubs, if they got a hold of your book, looked at it and thought, let's bring this guy in to be a consultant. If they brought you in a room, not to make you give stuff away for free, but what would be some of the things that would come to your mind first and foremost? What can the owners of the Cubs learn from what was done to modernize Fenway and turn it into the kind of place that would be sustainable for decades to come?
Well, let me just start off by saying, you know that guy we were talking about earlier, Ken Palmer?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be running out to Chicago. My publisher's out there. And three days that the Phillies are out at Wrigley, we're going to be taking in a couple of night games and a day game. I'm going to be doing some shooting. You're blowing my cover here, Rick. But, sure. I'm on a list of people that are going to be used as a consultant to a Wrigley book and maybe to,
wow,
to do some of the things you were just talking about. But I want to be, my whole idea is list Schmidt. I'm going to throw my stuff on the table and everybody else throw theirs on too, and then we'll work it out, you know? But, you know, without being that cavalier about anything, we're just going to go out there and enjoy some games. And as you know, the lockout's kind of been working for me because Kenny's been making some phone calls on my behalf.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to go out and enjoy some Phillies Cubs at the Wrigley. And I'm going to meet a couple of people that helped out with the book and enjoy a couple of brats and some beers. Hopefully come back with a handful of beautiful pictures to, set the table. And but what they could do at Wrigley is just leave well enough alone, you know, and I really mean that. If they could do anything to actually, as the Red Sox say, improve the ballpark, it would be to retrofit it the way it was back 30, 40 years ago and maybe open up some of the concourses which have been closed. I'm not a true student of Wrigley Field. I've been there a handful of times. But this time I'm going out there with a mission. You know, with a, mm-hmm. I have a mission statement, and like I said, it's to set the table with beautiful images. So I'm going to be looking around myself. But I'm very happy to you know, actually we're working on another project too, which a lot of people don't even know. The Dodger Stadium is the third oldest ballpark, and it's going to be 50 years old next year. So I've already started working on that as well. But as everybody does know, the Dodgers are in a state of flux.
To be kind.
Know, I don't know, you know, if they even have any gravity left on that planet. I have no idea what's going on there, but I'm sure Bud Selig and a couple other people will let us know about that soon. So, you know, it's just being fascinated with places that have been such an important part of people's lives for so many people for so long, you know, and on that note, I would just say, you know, God bless the Yankees. I've never had one bad thing to say about the Yankees organization other than, why the hell did you move it across the street?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, use some ingenuity and save what you got. I just watched, I'm watching HBO 2 here in my hotel room. I just watched the Mickey Mantle biography. And, you know, he almost was in, he had me in tears nearly right before you called when he was like, how anybody could have said here a couple of days before he died that he was the luckiest man in the world right here on this hallowed ground. Just with that statement alone, I would do everything in my power to incorporate all of the knowledge in Manhattan and beyond to save that ballpark. But, you know, you go there now and you want your yuppiedom and you want to hear the cash register going off instead of Bob Shepard's voice, then that's what you got. Enjoy.
Yeah. No, I agree with that, and it was a sore spot with me when they tore that down, and Tiger Stadium also, as you addressed in the book, that was
right.
Horrible that was allowed to happen. My last question for you on the subject of the Yankees, all right, for all the folks like myself who are not Red Sox fans, I'm a lifelong Indians fan, albeit an embittered one because I loathe our pathetic ownership. But that aside, I doesn't make me a fan of any other teams here. For all the people like myself in recent years that are throwing around the term Yankees Jr. at the Red Sox here, because you guys now, again, second biggest bully on the block, at least financially and everything. Yeah, Fenway has been, you know, turned into somewhat of a cash register because of the ticket prices and everything they've been able to do with monetizing. And, yeah, they've put it back into the team. And, yeah, quite frankly, I wish my ownership was as committed to winning. But be that as it may, for those of us who look at that, who look at what looked to be a lot of obnoxious front-running fans, there's a lot of them like you that were fans. But you got to admit, there's a lot of crisp new Red Sox T-shirts out there from folks claiming to have been fans since well before 2004. For all of that, what do you, as a lifelong Red Sox fan, say about that transforming image since your team won the World Series in 2004?
Well, I'm just glad that we haven't bit into the apple so hard that we have the taste of entitlement. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
We still understand what it means to be a Red Sox fan. We understand that, you know, whether it was with a thud or with a little crispy tinkle, it was somehow going to go wrong. So that, in many ways, helped us as New Englanders, you know, get ready for the rest of the year. You know, hey, here comes winter. You know what I mean? But let me just give a shout-out, first of all, to Bart Swain, the media relations director at the Indians, one of the greatest guys in baseball that I've known for years. Just an acquaintance, but I'll tell you, he really is a class act. And I love the tribe. I love the whole feeling there at the Jay, or what Progressive Field, whatever you want to call it now. I mean, it's a little sad when, the Red Sox or the Yankees are in town and they were only drawing 5,000 or 6,000 and those guys are on the bleachers beating that drum. But that's what holds it all together, man. And the Red Sox, you know, you talked about the highest ticket prices. Well, when you get the tiniest, most popular ballpark in the country, you got to charge something for those seats, you know. And if your bleacher seat at one point was maybe $10 or $15 and then it jumped to $25, well, that's because you're still there with only 38,000 of your friends. You know
right.
what I'm saying? So
right.
there is a price to be paid. And if you look through the book carefully, I tell people exactly how to get into Fenway Park if they can just be patient and maybe not have to jump in and, you know, rush Poppy and scream Poppy, 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 Poppy the whole time.
Right.
If you're patient, you can get a nice ticket out on the street. You can get a nice standing room ticket right before the game for $20, $25. You know, it's not impossible. It's one of the things I think the Red Sox have consciously done is to make tickets available. Yes, you have to pay the price, like I said, but they're there, and you can come on in, and I swear to God, if it doesn't welcome you and tell you all these wonderful things about baseball and make you feel good about yourself and let you marvel in the glory, then it's not Fenway Park. There's a problem with you.
Right.
I'm kidding. But
yeah, you got to love
Fenway's
it.
Fenway's a pretty great place.
Exactly.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
And it's interesting to hear you speaking warm. We have a relationship with the Tribe front office. I think my picture's on a dartboard down there because you're either with the front office or you're against them. They're very, very insular in that.
I don't know anybody else there, but Bart Swain was taking care of Kenny P and I when we first met back in 1991, 92, when we first started covering the Giants. I had already covered the Red Sox for a little while, but we were out there for a preseason game. Let me tell you, I think it was Dave O'Brien was our quarterback, and Keith Elias was our star running back. It was crazy. But I called over there and told him who I was, and sure enough, Bart was kind enough to hook us up, and we got some great interviews with Oral Hershiser and Dave Winfield and stuff. And he's always been very good to me. Even last year when I was putting the book together, I made sure when I went on the road to go on the road in Cleveland because I knew Bart would be great and I knew Cleveland would be pretty good too.
Well, that's awesome. John, I hope to catch you next time you're in town. And I'm holding up your book again, which, again, you guys were kind enough to send. Thank you. Holding it up for our high-definition cameras here. Why Fenway? Exploring the Red Sox mystique. John, look forward to the subsequent projects to come here, and I look forward to talking to you subsequently on the FDH Lounge. Thank you so much.
Rick, thanks very much for having me on, man. Have a good night.
Oh, no problem, no problem. Give my best to Palmer. We love that guy.
All right, I'll probably see you Thursday or Friday. Go down to the beach and see what's working down there.
I'm trying to get him to come in for the Penn State-Ohio State game in the Shoe this year. I'm going to be there because my dad's got season tickets. I hope to meet Kenny that weekend.
Well, I'll tell you something. If I have my dithers, we're going to be at the Shoe, so.
Awesome.
Let's see what we can do. But
look forward to meeting both.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I hope to meet both you guys. That's all I was going to say.
Excellent, Rick. And I hope Ohio State, I'm sure you're a fan, I hope they can make it through this little turmoil they have right now.
Hopefully. All right, thanks, John. Appreciate it.
All right, brother. Take care.
All right,
bye-bye.
Thanks. The great John Ferguson, everybody. Great photographer and writer.